From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, April 25th through Friday, April 29th, 2022. It was a stressful week of economic uncertainty, the bloodiness of war, drought in the West, fires across the country, crime in the cities, partisan mudslinging in the media, COVID wish thinking in our foggy heads, and Elon Musk everywhere. We're about to embark upon a powerful hour of Black Belt Talk Radio, during which your tolerance for hearing different but legitimate points of view will be tested. We've got lefties, we've got righties, we've got fence-sitters. Please, don't get angry. Just listen closely, and while doing so, maintain a degree of educated skepticism, regardless of whether or not you agree. We'll be joined by Kevin Casey with the Talker's Top 10 Stories of the Week, along with Matthew B. Harrison in Springfield, Massachusetts, on Musk and Twitter, Greg Stebbin in Warsaw, Poland, on the war and its refugees, Bill Brady in Phoenix, on Trump and the GOP, and Victoria Jones in the nation's capital, on Boris Johnson, and a woman with allegedly active legs. Influential yappers from across the country with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do a daily dance of affirmation in a fragmented, noisy world where we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap. Heard coast to coast and around the world on great radio stations across the U.S. and the U.K. The past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information's gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. This installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap is being brought to you in part by the classic rock band Gun Hill Road. Check them out at gunhillroadmusic.com. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, climate change. Historic drought in the West caused by what is being called a changing climate by Southern California officials has prompted them to demand that businesses and residences in parts of Los Angeles, Ventura, and San Bernardino counties cut outdoor watering to one day a week.
Firefighters across the country are battling multiple wildfires as dry conditions and high winds fan deadly flames in Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Virginia, South Dakota, Texas, and Florida.
At number 9, immigration. The crisis on the southern border continues as a bipartisan group of United States senators is formally launching immigration talks this coming week.
Meantime, the far left and more moderate factions of the Democrats in Congress are at odds with each other over whether or not President Biden should repeal the Trump administration's Title 42, which was originally put in place to restrict immigration during the COVID-19 pandemic.
At number 8, race relations. A new poll taken by the Los Angeles Times shows LA residents are deeply pessimistic about race relations some 30 years after the Rodney King riots.
Meantime, all across the country, controversy rages on about the teaching of critical race theory in the public schools as it increasingly grows as a divisive political issue.
At number 7, crime and violence. The crime statistics in the nation's cities from Los Angeles to New York continue to spike, also fueling racial strife, particularly over the methods of policing employed in urban areas.
The festering element of rising homelessness on the city streets of America is a major component of the crime problem.
At number 6, a tie between the January 6th committee and Donald Trump activities. The chair of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol Hill riot announced Thursday that the panel will hold 8 public hearings spread out throughout the month of June.
Democrat Representative Benny Thompson, who heads the committee, said the hearings will be a mixture of some prime time and some regular, and they will tell the story about what happened. The big question at this point is, after all this time, will Americans still be paying attention?
At number five, a tie between partisan politics in general and the midterm elections. In case you haven't noticed, the divide between red and blue has widened, and the rhetoric continues to heat up as the midterm elections draw closer and closer.
As President Biden's approval ratings continue to sink, polls still indicate the GOP has a very good chance of regaining control of both houses of Congress. And through this process, former President Trump plays his hand as a potential Republican Party kingmaker and GOP presidential standard bearer in 2024.
At number four, COVID-19. Dr. Anthony Fauci said the U.S. is, quote, out of the pandemic phase, end quote, with COVID-19, but he's still taking some precautions. He later walked his statement back a bit, saying his words could have led to some misinterpretation. And he clarified that he was talking about an acute fulminant phase, whatever that means. Actually, it means a severe and sudden outbreak of a disease.
The latest stats, U.S. COVID cases are up, but hospitalizations remain low and deaths are dropping.
At number three, the Russia-Ukraine war and U.S. policy. The war grinds on and the suffering continues and the danger remains intense.
The question now is, how long can the American media, political establishment, and public remain focused on it with all the other problems facing the nation?
At number two, Elon Musk to acquire Twitter. There is tremendous media and public interest in this story, which underscores the important stature and influence Twitter and social media have achieved in our society.
And speculation abounds over the implications Musk's acquisition will have on the First Amendment and free speech. There's the growing question, regardless of their stated ideology on free expression, is the ability of one mega wealthy individual such as Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos to buy their way into a position of sheer power over major communications platforms as much, if not more, of a threat to our democracy as that wielded by corporate interests?
And at number one this week, the economy. For the second week in a row, conversation about inflation, supply chain breakdowns, and the unsettled psyche of the American labor force has been even louder than discussion about the war, the pandemic, rising crime, and all of the rest.
And now, with the economy showing signs of actually shrinking, economists and bankers are warning of a coming recession. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. There was a huge buzz in talk media this week about the adventures of Elon Musk and his bid to buy Twitter. Joining us now is the producer of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an associate publisher of Talkers. He's also a media attorney, and he teaches law at Western New England University School of Law, Matthew B. Harrison. You know, it's amazing, Matthew, but this week, more people on talk radio have been talking about, or there has been more conversation on talk radio about Elon Musk taking over or acquiring Twitter than COVID-19 or the war between Russia and Ukraine. Only the economy is bigger. So it's very interesting, the fascination people have, one, with Elon Musk, and two, with social media.
Well, Elon Musk does not yet own the company, but it seems like it's going to go that way if stockholders, in fact, vote in accordance to this, which could easily be a done deal or not, depending upon how regulators want to go. But he's already acting as if he owns the company. He took aim at some Twitter employees and other board members, suggesting that there's no need to pay them anymore. Also, he suggested that he would buy Coca-Cola next so that he could put cocaine back into the recipe.
He's kidding.
Presumably tongue-in-cheek, yes. He tweeted that past moderation decisions by Twitter's top lawyer and safety expert were incredibly inappropriate, questioning their independence and ability to be fair. Mm-hmm. Former CEO of Twitter, Dick Costolo, tweeted actually that bullying is not leadership, and people are suggesting that Musk has a very hands-on, hard grip way of dealing with people, and they're comparing it to bullying. Mm. The current CEO tried to defend the staff, suggesting that, you know, he's proud of employees as they're trying to improve Twitter, but ultimately there's not much to be said about the way that they had been doing things. It's more about what is Musk going to change.
Yeah, well, I mean, the word out is that the employees, generally those who have a liberal bent, and let's face it, that most of the criticism against bias in social media, including and in some cases in particular Twitter, is that they have a left-leaning bias. And the proof is in the pudding. The conservative employees, if there are any, have not been complaining, but that there's been a meltdown going on. Again, this is what I've read. I don't know any employees at Twitter, so I don't know firsthand or even secondhand. I just know what I read and hear in the media is that there's been a meltdown. I mean, people are terribly upset that their company is going to be run by Musk, which kind of answers, the question about the vagueness about this guy. You know, how vague things are in terms of his politics and even when he's serious versus when he's kidding, such as that cocaine remark. He tends to camouflage his press releases, his tweets, his communiques that are truthful by surrounding them with funny stuff and sarcastic stuff and ironic stuff. So he remains a mystery, but clearly the liberals that work there are not very happy. So there's a little political hint of what's going on.
Additionally, many conservative pundits, talk show hosts, and television news people have claimed that following accounts have skyrocketed since the announcement, suggesting that perhaps the company is releasing these people from their digital house arrest in preparation for Musk's takeover.
The other issue that surrounds all this is it has to do with freedom and democracy in general. One of the ideologies of the left versus the right is the power of the state. We always feel that when we discuss American freedom and American politics and American capitalism, that private industry, the private sector, has to be protected from a overreaching government, the power of the state that would be behind socialism or communism. But what we're seeing now with the emergence of these mega billionaires just using their clout financially, and these guys seem to be way beyond Donald Trump in terms of power, Bezos, Elon Musk, people of that ilk who are able to just absolutely buy their way into controlling the means of communication and the means of power. Then you production, and then you look at that word bullying. Some people think, and I have to tell you, my red flag is up, that a whole new danger to democracy comes from these mega billionaires being able to just buy their way into enormous power, and there's nobody to stop them. And I think that's a very interesting development in terms of 21st century politics in America. I would imagine that the legal community in which you are involved is already thinking about this.
Yeah. And Musk has said on more than one occasion that free speech is the bedrock of a functioning democracy, and it's important for our civilization. And Twitter is going to be the digital, it already is, the digital town square where, you know, the future of humanity is going to be debated. He has these ideals that is not backed up with anything, but at least he's at least expressing that all types of communication, whether he's joking or not, should be at least accepted on the forum.
Yes, but it's free speech according to whom? It's free speech according to Musk. It goes back to the old statement that the best form of government would be a benevolent dictatorship. But there's also that phrase from literature, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it's sort of an ideal that never could be achieved in reality. Interesting times, indeed. How do you feel about it personally?
Well, I'm sort of watching the stocks at the moment, because as part of this deal, Twitter would be taking on a significant amount of debt. And based upon their recent earnings report, it's pretty modest relative to the increased interest bill that they would be getting with that debt. They have about $5 billion on their balance sheet in debt right now. Tesla, their stock has fallen by about 20% since Musk revealed his stake in Twitter, which kind of signals that perhaps people are worried that he's going to be even more distracted, or worse, that he's using his shares in Tesla as collateral for these bank loans.
That's my son, Matthew B. Harrison. He's the producer of this show. He's associate publisher of Talkers, and he's an attorney who teaches media law at Western New England University School of Law. Coming up next, a conversation with our correspondent Greg Stebbin on the ground in Warsaw, Poland. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the great bands of the golden age of album rock, Gun Hill Road, has been around for more than 50 years. The members of Gun Hill Road are Steve Goldrich, Paul Reich, Glenn Leopold, Brian Coonan, and yours truly, Michael Harrison. I wrote the lyrics to a song on our new album, What Year Is This? It's titled, I Know You're Real. It's about the relationship between human beings and our friends in the animal kingdom.
I know you're real.
Take a moment to write down the following web address to see the music video of this inspirational song that contains some wonderful animal images that'll rock your heart and soothe your soul. Here's the address. Write it down. IKnowYouAreReal.com. That's IKnowYouAreReal.com. If you love animals, you'll feel real good after seeing this video. IKnowYouAreReal. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. The Russia-Ukraine war remains an international calamity and one that we'll be talking about for weeks, if not months, to come. Or will we? Is there the danger that the American media and public will begin experiencing Ukraine fatigue? Joining us is a correspondent for the website Beams, filing a special report to us from Warsaw, Poland, Greg Stebbin.
I am in Warsaw, which is the capital of Poland. Yesterday I was in Krakow, which is closer to the border, and I can explain why as we're talking here, why I was in Krakow. Warsaw, as you may know, is the city that has absorbed, I think, the most Ukrainian refugees of any place in the world. They put the number at about 300,000, which increased the population somewhere between 15 and 20%. And it's amazing how well the city is functioning, given that number of people who fled into the city in a very short period of time.
So what you're saying is the Polish people, particularly the residents of Warsaw, are being friendly, accommodating, and welcoming to the Ukrainian refugees?
Oh, it's far better than that. Imagine if you woke up in the middle of the night and your neighbor's house was burning down. I suspect that your impulse would be to run and do anything you could to help. And that's what the people of Warsaw did. I mean, we saw it all in, you know, pictures and video of people driving to the border. I have a friend whose son was taking his car back and forth, his car, a Tesla, back and forth and picking up refugees and driving them 5 or 6 or 7 hours back to Warsaw, people opening their homes and saying, please sleep here. Let me make you a meal. People providing food, clothes, jobs. I mean, it's like their neighbor's house was burning down, and they ran and said, we'll do anything we can to help you. What do you need? It's going to be a case study for history of how the Poles, particularly in Warsaw, responded, because you would never have expected it. And they've gone way above the call of duty. And I think the Ukrainians certainly saw it and appreciated it as well.
You're interacting, from what I understand, with these Ukrainian refugees in Warsaw. What are your findings? Tell us about this experience that you're going through in interacting with these people who are going through such crisis in their lives.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've been volunteering at the Warsaw Central train station, and I want to put into perspective what that means to a Ukrainian refugee. So they spent a number of days getting to the Polish border. You know, their lives at at many times during that period were at risk. They finally got across the border and they're safe. They get on a train and they go right to Warsaw. And so if you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, first they're just trying to save their lives. Now they're on a train to Warsaw, and I have to think that the next thing they're wondering is, what am I going to do next? Well, some hours later, when they get off the train in Warsaw, they walk into the World Central Kitchen, and I hand them a cup of coffee. And then I watch as families, mostly women with children, because, as you know, the men have to stay behind and fight. I would just watch these families. Maybe they had a roller bag, you know, like the kind you and I take for a weekend away, but we know we're going home. Mm-hmm. They don't know when or if they're going home, but that's all they have. Or maybe they have their stuff in plastic shopping bags, and suddenly they're sitting in a tent at a picnic table, drinking a cup of coffee, having some food from also from World Central Kitchen, and you can see it in their faces. All of a sudden, they're not moving anymore, and they're safe. But safe is not enough. What am I going to do next? And it's heartbreaking to watch them as they're sitting there and beginning to think, what are even my options? I didn't prepare for this.
Not to mention,
that's what I saw time and time again with the Ukrainians that I made a cup of coffee for.
Not to mention the men they left behind, the fathers, the husbands. That has to be terrifying, knowing that you're leaving your country with a bag of possessions from a life that you've been living, some kind of normal family life or some type of just normal life. And not only don't you know what your options are or your future is, but you don't know the safety of the man you left behind, a husband, a father.
Well, right.
That has to be terrifying.
And let me up the ante on that a little bit. Now I just took the train from Warsaw to Krakow and back this weekend. The cell reception along the way is not very good. So this may also be the first time they have a reliable cell reception. And when they call the husband or the father or the son and he doesn't answer, does that just mean he doesn't have cell service? Maybe the Russians knocked it out? Or does it mean something worse? I mean, they're just living in a world of terror and unknown. And to sit there and watch and think to myself, I've never known anything like this in my life, and I hope to God I never do.
Yeah. Do you speak Ukrainian or Polish?
Not a word. Well,
how has it been?
I know how to say hello in Ukrainian, and I notice how to say about five words in Polish. I really came here not because I knew anything of the region, but because I'm Jewish. I grew up hearing adults say as a kid, never again, never again. And I looked at what was happening here and I said, never again. I don't want to look back on this time and say, I could have done more. So I said, what can I do? And that's why I'm here.
Is there a general understanding of the history of World War II, Hitler, Nazism, the attack on Poland, Czechoslovakia, France, etc.? Would you say that the young people there know more about that than the young people in the U.S.?
By at least 10,000%.
Oh, my.
Because they live it every day. You know, Ukraine has been free for 30 years. Poland has been free not much longer. So this relationship with Russia and the conflict and the strife of Europe is very, very fresh. So even if you were born 20 years ago, you've heard it, you studied it, you know it. And it's important to you because, frankly, I think unlike most of us in the U.S., they have never assumed that something like this couldn't happen. Whereas in the U.S., we're blessed to be able to say it's never going to happen here. But, of course, it did on 9/11 and it did at Pearl Harbor.
No doubt. These are very educational experiences on a massive level. Tell us about the ambulance situation.
So what's happening in Ukraine is that ambulances are being used as mobile hospitals. So we typically think of an ambulance as a machine for transport. You had a car wreck, someone got sick at your house, the ambulance comes and takes them to the hospital. In Ukraine, the ambulance is the hospital. And once you think about it, that makes perfect sense. But of course, the Ukrainians figured that out, and so did the Russians. So one of the things the Russians have been doing is systematically blowing up the Ukrainian ambulances. So I'm working with a group from Belgium, and there's lots of other smaller groups doing the same thing. But this group in Belgium called BE for Ukraine, BE stands for Belgium, BE for Ukraine, is raising money to replace those ambulances as fast as they can. So the reason I was in Krakow yesterday is they were driving 6 brand new, beautiful ambulances, each one packed with donated medical supplies to the border to hand over to the Ukrainian army. And they're doing it over and over and over again. And this is an organization that didn't exist 2 months ago when the invasion happened. But it's just a bunch of people in Belgium that got together and said, what can we do? They figured out this is what they could do. And in less than 2 months, they've raised over $1 million to buy ambulances and some other things like transport supplies and things like that.
We're going to share with our listeners how they can participate in this in just a moment. But how did you, an American media guy, connect with all these people? I mean, you said that you were inspired to because of your background and the history that you understand. But how did you go about getting into this thing?
The truth is, my background in radio is an interesting one. There's been times in my life where I spent more time on the radio than people got paid to be on the radio. I worked for a magazine called Men's Health for 20 years, and I made up a job for myself called Radio Spokesman. And every month, and I bet a lot of people listening have heard me, every month I would pick a couple of stories from Men's Health that I would see as really good to talk about on the radio, and I would send them out to all my friends at radio stations, and I would do 100, 200 radio interviews a month talking about those stories in Men's Health. And it worked really well because I like to think I sound pretty good on the radio, but also Men's Health has such credibility. It's such a reliable source of information that all my friends at radio stations loved having me on because it was a great, reliable source of information. And I hope, generally speaking, well told. And when this invasion happened, I thought to myself, what can I do? And I realized what I could do is go to Warsaw, go to the border, and do as many radio interviews as I can for a couple of reasons. One, to raise money for things like these ambulances. But the other thing is, Michael, one of my biggest fears with this conflict is that at some point, we're just going to get desensitized to it, and we're going to stop paying attention a little bit at a time. And I think that's part of what Putin wants. I think he knows if he can stretch this out long enough, our attention's going to be diverted, and it's going to be easier and easier for him to do terrible, terrible things. And I think we're already seeing that.
He has an understanding of American pop culture, and I have no idea what the attention span of the average Russian citizen is within their media culture. But I agree with you that there's a distinct danger that Americans, and not just American consumers of media, but Americans purveyors of media, are going to just get tired of the story. It'll just fade into the background. As a matter of fact, this was the first week, this past week, at the time we're having this conversation, I don't know how the talker's research will fall out, but last week was the first week in approximately 6 straight weeks that the Russia-Ukraine war was not number one on the talker's conversation charts. It was number 2, which is not chopped liver. The economy is number one. And you're hearing a lot of Americans say, oh, I care about what's going on in Ukraine. I care about these people. We care about Putin. We care about the danger. But I care about what it's costing me at the gas pump. I care about, you know, what's happening in terms of housing, the grocery stores, what's being taught at the schools, and on and on and on. So there is that danger. And that's actually a syndrome of modern times in terms of attention span. And journalists have a hell of a time with that because sometimes they have to abandon a story no matter how important it is to move on to the next flashy, you know, flashy celebrity gossip or something of that nature. As a person who understands these things, what's your observation of the media in Poland in terms of the dissemination of information to the public?
Well, I don't know that I can comment well about the media in Poland because I don't understand Polish. I did just ask a friend of mine a similar question, and she said something that frankly didn't surprise me at all. She said, one of the dangers here in Poland is we rose to the occasion with such energy and such passion. But now there's a fear that there's going to be a second wave as big as the first wave of refugees. And are we going to be able to do it again? And I think that's it's a very legitimate concern, not just of the people, but also can the economy here in Poland take it? So I think that's a big issue. But I also want to say, when you talk about American media, one of the things that concerned me, and I think it was a really interesting kind of a test case of our attention, was it seemed to me as an observer, and maybe your data says something different, so this is just my observation, but it seemed to me that for about a week, Will Smith and Chris Rock were way more important in the media than Ukraine. And that really scared me for two reasons. One was, look, was it a pretty astounding thing to have happen? Absolutely. Does it compare to a war in Eastern Europe? Absolutely not. And so that really scared me. But the other thing is, it's one of those things that actually feeds into Vladimir Putin's narrative about the West, that we let Hollywood run things and we're concentrating on trivial things. And, you know, he just got to use that as evidence to his people that what he's doing in Ukraine is right.
How can people listening to this help with the ambulance, because that's a tangible, charitable activity? How can they help raise money for the ambulance cause?
The website platform is called Beams with a Z, BEAMZ.LIVE/ambulance. And I want people to understand that every dollar we collect is used towards buying ambulances. We're as committed to this as you are, and we're doing everything we can, and every dollar goes there because we want to get as many ambulances to Ukraine as fast as we can.
That's Greg Stebbin, a correspondent for the website Beams, reporting in from Warsaw, Poland, where he's covering the influx of refugees from the Russia-Ukraine war. Coming up next, a conversation with a talk show host at one of our leading affiliates, Bill Brady of KFNX Phoenix, about one of the most talked about individuals in the history of modern media, Donald Trump. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
This report is brought to you by Genesis 2 Project, G2P. Recently, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI, released a preliminary report on possible threats posed by UFOs, now known as Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, UAP, and the progress the Department of Defense UAP Task Force has made in understanding any threats. Dr. J.C. Van Valkenburg is a former Los Alamos National Lab biophysicist who has been working with G2P to bring scientifically sound UAP data to the public.
G2P has released the first scientifically authenticated documentation of UAPs, including images captured with infrared technology. Primo Forensics performed the digital forensic analysis.
In tandem with the ODNI report, these data support the development of relevant processes, policies, technologies, and training for the U.S. military and government personnel upon encountering UAP. Visit Genesis2Project.com.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. I was recently interviewed by Bill Brady, the owner of and talk show host at our Phoenix affiliate, 1100 KFNX, The Pulse of Arizona. Here's an interesting excerpt from that conversation.
Michael Harrison is with us. He's the publisher of Talkers.com, Talkers Magazine, has been the leading talk media authority now for a generation, going back to, I guess, 1989, we had identified as that. Now, I'd asked you on because you had mentioned to me that you were at a dinner with Trump recently. Tell us about that, and what was that like?
That was my second time that I was at a dinner with Trump, and I did not have direct dinner with him, just me and Trump. I was at a small dinner in which he participated, and I've had that opportunity twice, once when he was president and once now. Last week, I was invited to Mar-a-Lago with a mutual a friend, Christopher Ruddy, and I have been friends for a very long time, the CEO of Newsmax. And he invited me to join him at Mar-a-Lago for a dinner with Mike Huckabee and a small group of people, including President Trump, who lives there and is a fixture there. When former President Trump is not doing his rallies or on the road or doing things, he lives at Mar-a-Lago. And here's what I observed. First of all, the two times I have met Trump in the last several years, and he's in a place such as Mar-a-Lago or his golf club, which is the last time I had a chance to have a similar type of a dinner with him. He's very relaxed, and he's very, very funny, and he likes to play around and shtick with people. He likes teasing, and he's kind of a fun person if you're in a purely social situation with him, which is what I was doing. But right now, the life he's living, and I'll try to sum this up quickly, because it really is fascinating. The former president, the 45th president of the United States, is, if you take away everything and you look at it objectively, aside from the fact that at his castle in Palm Beach, Florida, he's running the shadow version of the Republican National Committee. I mean, he's basically running the Republican Party as much as a party can be run, because parties are amorphous, as you know, they evolve. They're very political. But aside from that, he's the maitre d' of a very fancy hotel restaurant and the DJ there. That's what he is, Bill. And he was dressed in a very nice sport jacket, open shirt, none of those big, long, ugly red ties that he wears. The hair was not orange. The hair was gray. The face was not orange. The face was a normal shade of, you know, human coloring. He didn't look like an orangutan. And the whole image of him that you see at the rallies with the hat, and he's angry and he's being crazy and egotistical and all the things, you know, that people either love or hate Trump, it just is not that guy. And do you like your food? How's the service? Did you see we have a buffet in the other room? If you want to try something, did you like the songs I was playing? And he's playing Elvis Presley. He's playing a whole variety of weird music, you know, popular songs from the past, present. Plays the same songs every night, I understand. Does it for about an hour. Schmoozes it up with everybody. Makes speeches at people's weddings. He is the maitre d'. A personable maitre. It's like when you go to a fancy restaurant, the chef comes out and talks to you at the table. And this is what Donald Trump does. And he lives over the store. He lives in the place. There's a very, very low-key presence, but they're there, of the Secret Service. And it was a wild experience seeing a president in the United States in that kind of environment.
Now, given all of that, there's a lot of conversation about the role of Trump. I think Chris Christie came out this week in an ABC interview and said that he did not think Trump would be determinative. I forget whether it was about 2022 or 2024. But what do you see, given the man that you observed recently at Mar-a-Lago, what do you see of his intentions for 2024 especially?
I have no doubt he intends to run for president in 2024, as he intends to be a tremendous factor in the GOP's retaking of the House and the Senate in 2022. I'm not predicting they will, but it appears that they certainly might. And he's very involved in that. He's doing what Nixon did. You know, he's running around after having lost and creating a new power base, and he's going to run again. The only thing I think that could stop Trump from running is the fact that, you know, he's advancing in his years, and he may not feel good, or anything can happen in the next 2 years that suddenly tilts the scales away from him. He could lose in the primaries. Somebody like DeSantis could come up, or somebody we don't even know about. But if all things stay on the trajectory they're on right now, I have no doubt that Trump is going to run for president and has a very good chance of being nominated. And at that point, he has a very good chance of being reelected.
Yeah, who knows what happens between now and then.
Right.
It is a long time, and a lot can change. I would be remiss in not asking about your impressions of what's going on with Ukraine and Russia and that war and how it fits into the history of the 21st century. The kind of invasion and brutality in it. What are your thoughts on the war?
Well, my personal feelings are that it's terribly dangerous. That's my first feeling, that we're certainly facing the unknown. If you look back at Europe in the 30s and the 40s, we're seeing that replayed. We're seeing a situation where appeasement will only embolden a vicious tyrant and a very dangerous country. The public there is not really tuned into what's going on. It shows why freedom of speech and freedom of the press is so important. And I don't think there's an easy answer to this. It would be lovely if they came up with some type of a negotiated settlement that kept Ukraine, a democracy and protected its poor people who are so beleaguered. I mean, it's tragic what's going on. It's absolutely horrific. But I think that it's a very dangerous situation, and there's no easy remedy, because the difference now than existed when Hitler was in a similar situation, threatening one nation after another, and you had Chamberlain in England and Churchill saying, you know, one thing, and Chamberlain appeasing Hitler, and then they got rid of him. Of course, Churchill was proven right. The difference then and now is they didn't have at that time, or they didn't know they were about to, have nuclear weapons. And I don't think it's beyond Putin to use them. So we have to hope that Russia, China, and those countries tumble from within, which they could if we play our cards right. But cool heads have to prevail, but not to the point of appeasement, because we've learned that lesson. Scary times, Bill. I wish I had a more positive outlook, and I wish I had a crystal ball and could tell you exactly what would happen. That I can't do, but I hope that my answer suffices your curiosity in terms of how I see it.
Well, no, I think your answer was right on target in regard to it. It's an altogether different situation. Appeasement will not work with somebody who will keep coming toward you until you flash a stop sign. And even flashing the stop sign could be dangerous because, you know, do you have, we've got under a minute here, you know, do you have effectively a guy committing a murder-suicide right now, or do you have a rational state actor? I kind of think I know the answer to that. Michael Harrison, thank you for joining us today.
That's an excerpt from a conversation I had the other day with the owner of our Phoenix affiliate, 1100 KFNX, The Pulse of Arizona, Bill Brady, in which I was interviewed by him on his show. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Well, we have time for one more. Let's check in with our international woman in the nation's capital, the executive director of the D.C. radio company, the one and only Victoria Jones.
Well, one of the things that's been bouncing around in my mind is, and often is the similarities and differences between what goes on here in the U.S. and what goes on in the U.K., because we're so the same and so different. And of course, I'm from the U.K., as some people might be able to guess. And the politics, you know, politics is fascinating. And there's always scandals in British politics because, you know, they seem to love it. And that one of the latest scandals is around Boris Johnson, the Conservative Prime Minister, because it always is. But actually, it's not anything Boris did. Surprise, surprise.
Aha. What didn't he do, or what did someone else do that involved him in a scandalous scenario?
Well, allegedly, according to a story in the Mail on Sunday, which is sometimes scurrilous and sometimes not, a Conservative member of Parliament, his own party, Anonymous, says that the female deputy Labour leader, so that's his sort of opposite, who sits across from him in the House of Commons, has been crossing and uncrossing her legs deliberately to distract him because she doesn't have the same debating skills as him, but she has other skills.
That's the oldest ploy in the book. You know, you take the big bad boy's eye off of the task at hand by having some type of flirtatious or lewd feminine decoy. So is there truth to this? Is there video of Boris's eyes diverting to his opponent's lower portions?
Well, there doesn't appear to be, and there also doesn't appear to be focus on people analyzing where Boris's eyes are going. The focus seems to be on, first of all, trying to out who the anonymous MP is, naturally. Also, you know, did she do it? Didn't she do it? But not really looking at video of it. And then the general sexism and misogyny in the House of Commons, which is rampant. And then this was followed up a couple of days later by a meeting of Conservative MPs, women, and peers, that's lords, who meet to discuss equality.
Wow.
And some of these women started saying, one woman says, "Well, I observed a Conservative MP, male, who knew I was watching him, watching pornography on his phone in the House." And
in
then
the
this
house?
Other woman said, "Well, so did I. I saw a man, a member of parliament." And they both went and told a senior member, "It was the same guy."
Well, I guess it's corroborated. You got two witnesses. That's really a crazy thing to do. Talk about arrogance or certainly recklessness to do that. You know, you mentioned the misogyny in the House of Commons, and many Americans, I don't know if most Americans that follow politics know that they have this thing called the Prime Minister answer session or question session.
Yeah.
Where the PM is sort of a target of all of the wildness that goes on in these House of Commons meetings and answers questions. And the president, he or she, the Prime Minister, he or she makes a statement, then takes, you know, criticisms and answers back. And when you think about Maggie Thatcher and Theresa May, that was the recent female prime minister,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, and she's a regular MP now.
They were up against it then, being women in basically a hostile environment just based on that. If, in fact, what you're saying is true, which I have no reason to believe it's not, that there's basically an anti-female attitude in that particular legislative body. So it makes what they did even more impressive, because I certainly know that Maggie Thatcher stood her ground. She was a tough cookie, to say the least.
Oh, she definitely had an iron fist. There's no question about it. And when you think that was back in 1980, well, she also had that handbag. And, you know, I think a lot of people thought she probably carried a brick in it to wallop people.
That's the executive director of the D.C. Radio Company and our Washington correspondent, Victoria Jones. And that about does it for this latest installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation, looking back at the week of Monday, April 25th through Friday, April 29th, 2022. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. The Michael Harrison Wrap. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications, presented in association with Talk Media Network and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved.